The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, and a solemn promise to make the analysis more interesting than the weekend's football. Leeds' second half display, the highlight of the weekend. Can't do it in the Championship, can do it in the Premier League. Patrick Bamford's hat-trick means Villa lose for the first time this season. What's up with Man City? Their worst start in 6 years after being held by West Ham. And where does that Antonio overhead kick stand on the Sinclair spectrum? Liverpool squeeze past Sheffield United. Will Fulham ever win again? Sid joins us as Real win El Clasico. And most importantly, Jonathan Wilson will be here to pay tribute to one of the founder members of this podcast, Kevin McCarra. We will, as always, take your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning. Good morning.
Hello, Max. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. John Bruin, you well?
I'm okay, Max. Yeah. How are you?
Oh, yeah, I'm really good. And Jordan Jarrett-Bryan, who refused to come on the pod until Aston Villa's winning run finished. Nice to see you, Jordan.
Damn right. Good morning, mate. How are you?
Come out of your Aston Villa's shaped hole. Steve says, where do all the goals go? And Carrie says, not to overreact to one round of fixtures, but is this the end of the fun? It wasn't a fascinating weekend of football, but we'll start at Villa Park then. Villa nil, Leeds 3. A tweet to the pod from Jordan Jarrett-Bryan. How did Villa do this weekend? I'm not sure you understand how this works, John. You're on the pod. You don't have to ask us any questions. You must have been very relieved, Jordan.
Oh, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I've been waiting for this for the last 2 weeks. First of all, I took a lot of flack from my pre-season analysis that I didn't particularly rate Dean Smith. I still don't rate him. However, I'm a fair man. I can see Barry come back in his seat there. I'm a fair man. So I will give credit for the start they've had. It's been a very, very good start. I think they had a very, very good transfer window. They brought in some really good players. And I have to admit that he was starting to show that maybe he could cut it in this league. Credit where it's due. This game, all out the window. I'm back to where I was initially. He's absolutely awful. 3-0 loss at home to Leeds. No, you know what I'll do? I'll put it down, Max, to a bad day. I don't think Aston Villa were very good. I thought Jack Grealish had a couple of moments in the game, but I thought he was largely, invisible. Leeds were on it. I'd like to kind of focus a little bit more on Leeds being good than Aston Villa being bad. I did a radio show on Friday after the game, and I've spent the whole weekend just gushing over Patrick Bamford's second goal. That for me is, I'm going to go early, goal of the season. I think people need to look at that goal and really look at how difficult it is to score with your left foot at the near post. Normally you go far post, top corner, but to put it in the, I loved it. That was football porn for me.
I'm gonna stop you. Really
go on.
The second goal takes a deflection, so it can't be goal of the season. The third goal is genius, right? The third goal is absolutely beautiful.
The third goal's lovely as well. It's very Bergkamp-esque, granted, but that second goal, I just loved it. Great technique. He's a player I had, like Dean Smith, doubts over when he could cut it in the Premier League, but he's showing so far that he's got the faith and confidence from his manager, and he's delivering. But yeah, Aston Villa, ha-ha.
I actually thought Villa played okay in this game. It's just Barry, Leeds were utterly brilliant.
Yeah, I didn't think Villa were particularly bad. They had several chances. They perhaps should have taken the lead before Bamford got going. They possibly should have had a penalty for a Douglas Costa foul on Grealish. But Leeds were, once they hit their stride, they were magnificent. The speed they launch counter-attacks with is just breathtaking. Again, the supreme fitness of the players. They just look a cut above every other team in terms of fitness in the Premier League. And two absolutely brilliant individual goals from Bamford. And I think that having the faith of his manager, as Jordan alluded to, I think that's something he perhaps hasn't had before, having the total faith of his manager. And that probably makes a huge difference to him as a player.
And John, Leeds did this without Calvin Phillips, who's a hugely influential player, without Liam Cooper as well. And it sort of didn't matter. I think Costa's brilliant. I think Harrison's brilliant. And then he makes that substitution after 21 minutes and brings this young lad, Jamie Shackleton, on, who looked like he'd been playing the Premier League for years.
Well, I suppose that's a tribute to Bielsa as a manager. It's that collective spirit, isn't it? That the thing that has impressed me so much about Leeds is that so many teams come up from the lower division and splash a lot of money, Jordan's favourites, Aston Villa, did that last season. Fulham did it a couple of years ago. And Leeds, obviously they're on a perhaps a reduced budget, have just stuck with most of the same players. A couple of additions there. Patrick Bamford is a player who's bounced between clubs. A lot was expected of him as a teenager, but has responded to Bielsa. I'm a little concerned, though, that he's not the most prolific of goal scorers, that he might have scored all his goals in one game. Listen, Leeds back in the Premier League, it's been everything we expected, really, hasn't it? They've been fantastic. The fitness that Barry speaks about, I just wonder how long that can sustain for, though, because the breakneck pace at which they play games, how can you do that for 38 matches plus changing cups and all the rest of it? But let's enjoy them while they're doing this right now.
This is going to be a really weird season. And I just feel like if Leeds can amass in the first half of the season enough points to get themselves a top 12, top 10 finish, no team looks serious right now, Max. There's no team that you look at and think they're a serious team. And I think if the likes of Everton or in Leeds can even amass 50, 60 points, I don't know. I think those teams could be looking at a top six spot if they really hold it together.
Liverpool beat Sheffield United 2-1. And you say, Jordan, you know, no team is really serious right now. And I think, is it the fact that Liverpool are second without really doing anything great so far, a sign that they are probably still the favourites to win the division?
Yeah, Liverpool are still my favourites. I tipped them pre-season just because they're the only team I saw with a defence. Now Van Dijk's obviously out. That changes that a little bit. I still have them as my favourites because I still think over the course of the season, they will concede the least goals. He says that 2 weeks after they let in 7 against Aston Villa. But I think they will, over the course of the season, finish in the top two. But yeah, I think other teams should be looking at that and thinking, if Liverpool are the team to beat, then the bar isn't crazy high in terms of points amassed and clean sheets to keep.
Barry, what did you make of this game? I thought Sheffield United would be disappointed with the nature of the goals that they let in.
Yeah, they will. I thought they played very well, and watching them play, I haven't seen a huge amount of them this season. I was baffled as to how they only have 1 point. George Baldock wreaked absolute havoc down the wing, gave Andy Robertson a terrible time. Both Sheffield United wide players, really, Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold struggled. Joe Gomez, I thought, played well, but in the air, Ollie McBurnie just bullied him throughout and gave him a very difficult time. That will give Jurgen Klopp food for thought. But the goals they conceded were sloppy. Blokes losing their men. Both came from preventable crosses that perhaps should have been cut out. But look, Liverpool's front three are really good. And it's hard to keep tabs on them all the time.
John, for the first time this season, Liverpool fans are getting slightly upset with VAR. Do you think... Do you think that was a penalty?
Yes. Yeah. It's one of those things where if that was given as a foul, so, you know, 6 yards deeper into the field, you'd say, yeah, that was a foul. But because it was on the line, so therefore, and it's given as a foul, it's a penalty. It's interesting, isn't it, that the VAR conspiracies are being thrown out now. Particularly after last week's Jordan Pickford, Virgil van Dijk incident. It's all a bit unseemly, isn't it? I don't think, you know, it was a penalty. Accept it, move on, win the game, which is exactly what they did. Liverpool are not in great form, but they're at the top of the table. And that's, you know, and you look at the rest of, you know, City, United, whoever else, they're way below. And, I mean, you mentioned a front three. It was actually almost a front four, wasn't it? Because Jota played in that team as well. And I think, actually, this is a season where maybe the team with the best goal scorer takes it away. And he had a goal disallowed, but Salah looks absolutely red hot at the moment. Brilliant player, brilliant player.
Great question from James. After Salah's disallowed goal, should VAR introduce a beauty quotient that increases the amount you're allowed to be offside for a goal whose quality is such that it just should stand? It was such, It was just two wonderful touches, wasn't it? It was a thing of absolute beauty. So I'm with James. I you know, a like a daylight beauty quotient, and then he would have been onside, and the goal would stand.
Just quickly, with relation to VAR as well, it is worth noting that Sheffield United were denied another clear penalty for a Diogo Jota trip on Sander Berge, which for some reason wasn't punished.
To the London Stadium, West Ham 1, Man City 1. Dale Johnson from ESPN saying Manchester City have only won one Premier League game while trailing at half-time in 25 years. I guess they haven't been trailing that often at half-time in the last few years. HJ says, will Pep last until Christmas? Jordan.
Yes, he will. He will last till Christmas. I've said previously that I don't feel Manchester City, the hierarchy, have the balls to question him and definitely not sack him. So no, I think he'll be there this season. I think the bigger question is, will he be there next season? And that is, I think, up for discussion. I think his contract runs out this season, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so.
So I think they need to be looking at planning for the future going forward. There's something about Pep Guardiola. He doesn't look quite at it for some. I can't quite put my finger on what it is. I don't know if he's kind of incorrect, because burnt out, and he's had his 3-4 years where he's given so much, back-to-back title wins. He's been humiliated by Liverpool last season, trailing by so many points, but he doesn't quite look like he's at it.
I really hope that they, Man City, follow the Manchester United Chelsea route and just get an old City legend to come in. Who would you like to come in? Richard Dunn?
Paul Dickoff?
Richard Edgehill? Alphonse Groenendijk. I could do this all night.
Yeah, oh no, come on. You can have 20 seconds, John. Michel Vonk.
Keith Curl, Paul Power, Neil McNabb.
Beautiful.
Nicky Somerby.
Rumoured to be a United fan, so maybe not. But
Sean Gota says producer Joel. Yes, that's a great idea.
Sean Gota is a good one. Yeah,
that's a great
idea. Sean Gota is basically Ole Gunnar Solskjaer of City, isn't he?
He is. That Antonio overhead kick. I gave it a 5.8 on the Trevor Sinclair spectrum because, well, he's not airborne and there's no scissor movement. And so you can't get higher than a 6. Barry, you think that I'm even being too generous with that, but it's a brilliant goal and it's brilliant strength. And Antonio is such a fantastic player. And, you know, him going off had a huge impact on this game.
Yeah, he is a brilliant player. I think he should be in the England squad. He's been in England squads before. He had to pull out of one with injury, didn't make an appearance the other time, but he is excellent. He's an outstanding player. West Ham are very lucky to have him, I think, because he should probably be at a bigger club, and they will miss him if he's out for a few weeks, which he might be because it looked like he did his hammy.
John, did you give West Ham any... I mean, I'm sure 4 weeks ago, I looked at West Ham's fixtures and I said they won't get a point.
You did, for weeks and weeks.
And since then, they're unbeaten. And but I mean, are they just giving their fans enough hope before it all falls apart again, or can you see a sort of more of a strategy here?
I think this will probably be a pretty solid season from West Ham. I think David Moyes has his critics. We know that, but his work and that of Alan Irving, while Moisey was in self-isolation, has been pretty outstanding. I think one of the things they've had... I mean, I went to this fixture last year when City won 5-1, completely took West Ham apart. It was Rodri's debut, actually. And West Ham's midfielders in this game made Rodri look not great, and Gundogan as well. You know, these are players that you would consider of a much higher level, and yet West Ham's work rate and the play of players like Mikel Antonio gave them a real fright. And you know, Jordan's there talking about Pep Guardiola. You know, he's in the lesser spotted fifth season-itis that he's got at this point. There are loads of questions about whether he's going to sign a new contract. And I think it's correct to say that... there is nobody at Manchester City to question him. You only have to look at his repeated failure to condemn his players, say Aguero last week for touching Sean Massey. It's almost as if City have got a problem in the fact that if Pep Guardiola becomes a lame duck manager, which is possible, it happened with Manuel Pellegrini a few years ago, what happens to City then? Because the plan was all about Pep Guardiola. What's the succession planning at this point? And I mean, we say all that, but I do think West Ham played well in this game. So it was a fair result, I think.
I think there's genuine questions about whether Manchester City definitely finish in the top four. I know that most people have been there top two for sure. I do, because I think, looking at their squad a few days ago, if you take out De Bruyne, Sterling, Aguero and the keeper.
But they're all there.
Well, but anyway, take those four players aside.
Okay.
How many world-class players definitively would you say they've got in their squad? There's a lot of good players in their squad. I don't think it's a banker. It's more than likely they will, but I don't think it's a banker anymore. They finished top four. And I think the Pep Guardiola issue, I think, is the biggest issue at that club as to can he motivate a group of players that we think of as having a team of packed world-class players. But when you really drill it down, I Laporte, very good. Is he world-class? I've never been a Kyle Walker fan. Cancelo,
no.
do you know what I mean? I think De Bruyne, Aguero, who's got injury problems, Sterling and the keeper aside, I'm not so sure that it's the team that we think is there. I'll give West Ham credit as well. I've been very critical of David Moyes over the years. I don't rate him at all. But the run they're on right now, I think, is worthy of credit. Some big wins, some away wins as well. So I think what they're doing at West Ham, they're a sneaky shout as well. But a little bit like Everton used to say on the pod I listened to a few years ago, they could just ever, you know, West Ham it up and, you know, end up finishing 12th or 15th. But at the moment, they're doing really, really well. And they're a team like Leeds, I think, should be looking at, you know what? This is not a great league this year so far. Can we finish in the top six?
Why can't you say Edison? Why do you have to say the keeper? Is it like Candyman?
I don't know.
Is it like Candyman? If you say it enough times, he just appears behind you and kills you.
I don't know. Edison, the goalkeeper.
Can I just make one more point about the point that Jordan makes, I think is very good, about the players City have signed. And do you know who I think doesn't think the players are that good? Pep Guardiola.
Right.
And that's a problem. I don't think he rates many of his players.
And that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at St Mary's. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Monday, the 9th of November, Barry. Me, you, Jonathan Wilson, Barney Ronay doing a live show. £6 pay-per-view. It's popular these days. But this game wasn't, you know, this wasn't free to air. We're putting this on especially, so we shouldn't get in trouble. Why should all the people come and watch it? It's like a live show without having to leave your house.
We don't charge you a subscription and we're not charged. So the pay-per-view isn't on top of a payment you're already making.
Unless, of course, you do subscribe because you're a good person.
Yeah, and obviously all the money will be going into the pockets of myself, yourself, Barney and Wilson. The Guardian won't be getting any of it. At least that's what I like to think, but I suspect that may not be the case. But yeah, please come along. The last one we did was great fun. We'll have a halftime spectacular. May not be Beyonce, but we'll rustle up something.
Absolutely, yeah. Come along. Details, we'll tweet them all out. And they'll be on the webpage of Football Weekly as well. Southampton 2, Everton 0. This result means that 2020-21 campaign, the first top flight season in which each side has lost at least one of their first six matches since 1967-68. Those hilarious Arsenal fans immediately had Invincibles trending on social media. A year exactly today since Southampton lost 9-0 to Leicester. They like to be reminded about that. Barry and I were speculating that this might have been the most interested we had ever been in a Southampton-Everton game, in which I promptly went out for a walk all afternoon. But I still was more interested than I normally have been. Were we right to be that interested, John?
Well, the results suggest that you were. Prior to this game, I'd been slightly concerned about Southampton. But it would seem that you shouldn't actually be too worried about Southampton because they have a good manager, don't they? Ralf Hasenhüttl. It was I think the first anniversary of the 9-0.
Mm.
And they celebrated it in style, really. Che Adams, he's taken a while to get there, but looks a player now, doesn't he? And good goal by James Ward-Prowse. Everton were disappointing, it has to be said. But yeah, I was with you yesterday when you were talking about great Southampton-Everton games, and I couldn't remember one either. So yeah, maybe this was the greatest ever Southampton-Everton game.
The red card was a big talking point, Jordan. Ancelotti said the red card was a joke. Maybe the fact that there was a lot of talk all week about Pickford and Richarlison against Liverpool affected the decision. Your thoughts?
No, not for me. It's a blatant red. I think he tried to nibble at him first time round, and he missed. And he's ran him down, chased him down. And he's, whether it's accident or not, I think it's irrelevant. He's he's caught the top of his ankle in motion. It looks worse as they always do, but it's a really, really bad one. I think intent is irrelevant here. So for me, it's a clear red card, and I think that it's a clear frustrated player that got done, tried to do him, got done again, and has accidentally harmed another player. So for me, I don't understand why people think it's even close. For me, it's a clear red. Unfortunate, but it is a clear red. Just on Hasenhüttl briefly as well. I think he's a brilliant manager. I remember saying to some United friends of mine when Mourinho was sacked, I said to them, you should look at Hasenhüttl. And they all laughed at me. And I think it was a snobbery of looking at someone who's at Southampton. And I think that he's a great manager. I think he's someone that is a great coach. There's been some shocking results at Southampton, the 9-0 aside from under him. But I think he's a guy that has a game plan. I think he makes players better. I think with better players, he could get better results. I think that's someone that United should have been looking at from the get-go when Mourinho was sacked. But they won't, because there's a snobbery about we don't look that far down the league for managers at that level. And I think he's someone they should have been looking at. Just quickly on Everton, there's something about Sigurdsson at Everton that I think whenever he plays, they seem to be really, really poor or even lose games. I think they need to look at that.
The Match of the Day commentator said, without Ancelotti, there would be no James Rodriguez. There would be no Allen. It made him sound quite the Lothario. I thought, I was like, wow. Who knew? Melvin says, watching Shane Long getting instructions before coming on in the 90+1 minute with his team 2-0 up, assume he wasn't supposed to mark anyone at corner in the 3 minutes left, what possible or extensive orders could he need? Don't score two own goals. I do like big notes being handed to substitutes and iPads being shown to them. Meanwhile, Southampton's kit I thought was lovely. And that Everton kit, Alex sent me a picture of some extra cool Breeze chewing gum, and it does look like that. And for that reason, I think they deserved no points from this game. Fulham 1, Crystal Palace 2. Crystal Palace are fifth. They're above Leeds, Barry. Why aren't we giving them any credit?
I'm not sure. Have we not given them any credit?
I don't know. I don't feel like I ever give Crystal Palace much credit.
I mean, I didn't expect Crystal Palace to do well this season. I didn't expect West Ham to do well this season. And they're both making me look an idiot. And it's something I don't normally need help with. It was an impressive performance. I thought Fulham were maybe a little unlucky. I would worry about Mitrovic's form. He missed another good chance in this game. Fulham have conceded a lot of early goals this season, and it's killing them. And I suspect this is something Roy Hodgson noticed. Palace scored with pretty much their first attack. With Zaha, who didn't get a move away in January, probably doesn't want to be there. If I was a Palace fan, I'd be worried about how the season will pan out for him. But he played in Riederwald, who scored. You were saying yesterday, Max, he's a player you hadn't really noticed, but he has been at Palace a long time. Ademola Lookman then hit the post twice for Fulham. He looks a class act in that team. I wouldn't necessarily give up the ghost on Fulham yet. I think they may still survive. But Zaha then scores the second. One thing I thought was very funny about that. So he scores the second. He has to slide in. He absolutely clatters his knee off the upright. He's clearly hit the sweet spot of his knee. We all know how painful that can be. And he's in pain, lying in the back of the net. And Mickey Batshuayi still comes in and sort of jumps on top of him. And if I was Zaha, I'd be just get off me. Go away. I'm in serious pain here.
The reason why I just briefly I would write Fulham off is because there aren't many crap teams this year in the league. Normally there's four or five teams you're like, they're crap, they're going to be down there. Bar West Brom, there isn't really an awful team. So I think Fulham may be the victims of the fact that you know, even the Brightons are doing okay. Villa, West Ham, these teams normally are down there early in the season. There's not many crap teams. There's no Norwich this season. So I think that's the reason why I would write them off early.
But you've already said, Jordan, Man City are crap. Villa are crap.
You're annoyed with Leeds as well. Yeah, how many
Leeds
enemies
aren't much good.
How many enemies do you want, Jordan? Arsenal 0, Leicester 1. Jamie Vardy spoke of the patience and the concentration that the players needed. Certainly, that's what you needed if you watched it. Another pretty poor game on pay-per-view. I mean, good to see the players, as producer Joel says, downing tools to support the fan boycott of pay-per-view. But look, Jamie Vardy loves scoring against Arsenal. 11 in 12. Leicester's first shot on target. It was a brilliant break. Tielemans to Cengizunda, perfect cross, nice header. Was this a tactical masterclass from Brendan Rodgers, John Bruin?
There's someone that I think is going to claim it as a tactical masterclass. And I'll leave you to guess who I think that might be. I do love Brendan. I mean, you know, you couldn't invent him, could you really? Jamie Vardy, he just gets better, doesn't he? I was reading yesterday morning about, and recalling this actually, that remember Arsenal tried to sign him back in, just ahead of Euro 2016 it was, wasn't it? And there was some sort of contractual deal where they could have got him for 10 million. And the comparison was made, and I'd never thought about this comparison, that Jamie Vardy could have been Arsenal's new Ian Wright. And actually, I think about Jamie Vardy and I think, if there's a player that he reminds me of, it is actually Ian Wright. And it's a late developer as a player, fantastically quick, even beyond his 30th birthday, and someone whose spirit and, you know, the way that just powers the rest of the team. Jamie Vardy, I was the guy that didn't rate him 6 or 7 years ago. He's proved me wrong. And he proves everybody wrong every season. You think he's going to slow down. He doesn't. He did come off the bench in this game, which was an interesting little diversion. But then again, he is working with Brendan Rodgers. And that, of course, was a masterstroke by the great man.
Yeah, almost got another, didn't he? Mark Albrighton beautifully set him up as well for a second chance. So the Arsenal point of view, Jordan, from an Arsenal fan?
The annoying thing for me as an Arsenal fan is that just on Jamie Vardy, we know what's going to happen. As an Arsenal fan, what I want from my team and what I was looking for from Mikel Arteta is surely all week you plan, even if you think he might be on the bench, you plan. If there's one thing you train for, it's we know, lads, when Jamie Vardy comes on the pitch, this is what's going to happen. Right. So when this happens, we do this. And it's like, what have you been doing all week? That's the biggest disappointment for me. Arsenal, I think, in the first half were good without being great. Created a couple of good chances. I thought the disallowed goal was harsh. I'll go further than that. It shouldn't have been disallowed at all.
Really?
Granit Xhaka, his eye line, he's not in the eye line of the keeper. So I don't understand why you can justifiably say he's blocking Schmeichel's view of point. He didn't touch the ball either. So why is it disallowed?
Barry, you're shaking your head. Are you agreeing with Jordan or agreeing with
me?
Yeah,
I agree. I was bamboozled by that decision. Oh, fair enough. To disallow that goal.
Well, I'll change my opinion then.
So but that aside, Arsenal ran out of ideas. The Ozil fanboys have come out again saying, oh, if Mesut Ozil was there, we would have created 10 chances. It's a myth. It's such a myth. But I think Arteta has to really... I saw some journalists tweeting last night that Mikel Arteta, is in the same group as Lampard and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, which I disagree with, because he's been in his job less time than those two managers. And secondly, he's got a trophy in the bag. But I'm a big Arteta fan. There are some question marks, though, over some of his management and in-game decisions. But a really bad loss. They've got United next week. That's a must-win for me, because otherwise people will start looking at Arteta and thinking, are you really the guy that can kick on at this club?
Let's go to Old Trafford then and talk about Solskjaer versus Lampard. Andy, should we praise Lampard for his either everyone scores or no one scores approach?
I love that.
pretty disappointing of Chelsea not to let Marcus Rashford score after he single-handedly has defeated... Well, I mean, the government are clinging on, aren't they? But he's basically beaten the government again. It wasn't a great football match, Barry, was it?
No, I didn't enjoy it at all. We give Frank Lampard loads of abuse on this podcast, and I think he deserves credit for keeping two consecutive clean sheets. He'll be delighted with that, because I don't think it's anything he's done before with Chelsea. And bit of a shame that they couldn't score, I suppose. But yeah, he is to be commended for sorting out his defensive issues, for the time being at least, by bringing in Thiago Silva, who's clearly a very, you know, a steady hand on the tiller, and the new goalkeeper had quite a good game as well. I think the save he made from Rashford was fairly routine, but he's getting overpraised for it because Kepa probably wouldn't have kept it out.
Bar is low.
Chelsea should have had a penalty as well, shouldn't they, John?
Yes, yeah. Afternoon grapple fans, as we put it in the 1980s. That's a wrestling gag, by the way.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Or Oak Ogan, as Patrice Evra called him. Yes, well, you know, this is again where we introduced the topic of VAR and the fact that when everyone was campaigning for video evidence, I suppose they used to call it back then, we forgot that actually there would be human beings on the end of this, and it is just like you can use a spreadsheet to put the amount of deaths from coronavirus in and it run out of space. The computers are always subject to computer error, so human error, and that is exactly what that was. It was a foul, it was a penalty. Chelsea had every right to be annoyed about that one.
Greg says, after Maguire's headlock didn't lead to a penalty, what other wrestling moves should be allowed on the pitch? Would you like to see Eric Bailly performing a figure four leg lock on Timo Werner? Or perhaps Olivier Giroud could very carefully climb onto the corner flag and jump off it with a chair and hit Dan James square in the head. I mean, it would have made the game better, wouldn't it? Cavani came on, Jordan, and he looked all right, didn't he? I mean, he's clearly a very talented player.
I saw with Cavani what Cavani does. He's sharp. He's got a very good eye in the box where the ball's going to be. He almost scored his first touch there. I think he'll be an asset to Manchester United, but I think he was a victim of a panic buy by the club. He'll score goals. I think Rashford hopefully will learn some things from him as well, of just penalty box finishing. But I don't think he's the answer to any kind of success they hope to bring this season.
I very much enjoyed Luke Shaw's booking as he ran like a Scooby-Doo baddie with his hands just right out in front of him to grab Reece James. Donny van der Beek wasn't on the pitch and the camera kept panning to him, John. Should he be sad or just, you know, give it a bit of time and he'll be fine?
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems United have got is that the assembled masses of Ajax glitterati have started piling in on United. I think Marco van Basten, Danny Blind, they've all piled in and said, you know, why did Donny join this club if they're not going to play him? Ollie said after how he'll get his games. But the thing is, when you've watched a game in which Manchester United are devoid of creativity and the creative player is left on the bench, then you begin to question the manager's decision and you begin to question why they actually signed Van der Beek and who actually signed him.
To be fair, Ajax didn't really miss Van der Beek at the weekend, didn't they?
Well, that's true.
They won 13-0 at VVV Venlo. Lee Catamol's VVV Venlo, but to be fair to Lee, he wasn't playing in that game. Finally, Wolves won, Newcastle won. This game, Barry, made me genuinely question whether I want to work in football anymore.
Really?
I was just like, it's, you know, it's Sunday afternoon now. Neither of them did anything. I mean, for about 80 minutes, I was sort of thinking, fair play to Martin Tyler and Jamie Carragher for like still being awake, just giving some sort of enthusiasm to what is just the most pedestrian game I've seen since, you know, the one before it. But yeah. it was really tiresome, this game, I thought.
Yeah, I seem to end up saying the same thing about Newcastle every single podcast. I totally get what Steve Bruce is doing. It works quite a lot of the time, enough of the time for them to be doing okay, but it is painful to watch. I loved the Jacob Murphy free kick. I thought that was so clever and just the execution was perfect as well. But it was, I watched a lot of football over the weekend. I think 7 matches in their entirety or more. And this was not a good one. There were several that were not good. But I don't want to just keep repeating myself about Newcastle. But what Bruce is doing kind of works, and I get why he's doing it, but I would not like to have to watch it every week.
All right, that'll do for part 2. Part 3, we'll begin with Sidlow out in Spain. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. No pod tomorrow, by the way. We're going to wait for the Champions League games. Do it on Wednesday. Okay, cool. I'm off for... that's not just you. I'm not telling you that, Sid.
I thought you were telling me.
I mean, I know you enjoy the pod, but I can text you and tell you.
Because Tuesday is sometimes me. I assumed you were actually telling me. Sorry, right? Christ alive.
Yeah. No pod. Keep that in, Joel, if it's fine.
Oh, right. That was actually for the show. I thought you were... When you then said that's not for the show. I thought you were trying to tell me that you were telling someone else rather than you were telling the audience. I hadn't really... No. Hey, audience, this is magnificent.
A big part of this podcast is for the audience.
I hadn't realized
not all of it,
that.
But quite a big part.
Flipping it. Sorry.
So, just to be clear, there's no pod on Tuesday. There is a pod on Wednesday. I'm going on a mini break, so Faker Others is hosting. Barry, Flo Lloyd Hughes, and Nick Ames will be the panel. Sid Lowe, who I'll introduce now. Hi, Sid.
Hi, Max.
Are you happy with that arrangement, or do you want me to change it? Do you want me to keep you updated with it?
I don't know what my name is anymore, let alone whether or not I'm happy with your arrangements.
Right. El Clasico, Barca 1, Real 3. I'm sure we agreed on Wednesday that Real were worse than Barca. So do we have to change that judgment?
Not exactly, because I think we'd also agreed that neither of them completely convinced us. I think we saw a performance in which Madrid responded and I think managed the game really quite well. But I don't think we saw a performance in which we thought Madrid were outstanding. It shouldn't be this way, but there are certain games that don't motivate Madrid or don't appear to motivate Madrid the way that they should. And the Barcelona Clásico was always like to be the same. I was talking to someone last night who works for a bookmakers in Spain, and he said that they didn't publish this, but they did like a kind of an internal study. And he said they worked out that over the last 3 times Real Madrid had won the Clásico were the 3 times in the last decade where their odds were the worst, that they were least likely to win it. So there's something about their ability to respond, or maybe just the ability of this game to be unpredictable. Although, of course, for a while, that wasn't unpredictable. You know, we went through that run, didn't we, where Barcelona won every time they went to the Bernabeu. Since Zidane's returned, Real Madrid haven't lost a Clásico. So I suppose you could say, well, so this was predictable, even if they both came into it in not great shape. So I don't think we revise that entirely. I think we do possibly tip some of the balance of the analysis towards Barcelona and their flaws rather than towards Madrid and theirs. But then we'd already said that those flaws were there with Barcelona.
I mean, it looked quite an open game, like a 1-1. Both sides had chances, didn't they?
Yeah, I thought the first... I must admit, my overall feeling was this wasn't great and these aren't great teams. But I thought the first hour was really quite enjoyable. The first half was quite open. You get that 1-minute spell where you get a Madrid chance, a Barca chance, a Madrid chance again, all in one minute. And it was quite open. They, you know, 2 goals really should have scored. Messi, the one that Courtois saves, and then the Benzema chance that saved by Neto. I think then you get 15 minutes at the start of the second half where I actually felt that Barcelona had started to take control and should have probably scored. You've got the Fati shot that goes just wide. You've got the Coutinho header that goes wide of the near post. If he goes across goal, perhaps he scores. And then Madrid get the penalty. And for me, in a way, one of the things that I think is really interesting about that is that Madrid get the penalty that it's 60 minutes. There's still half an hour to go. And I feel bad because I wrote in my match report the classic linking line between conceding a goal and what comes next. Do you write the line, Madrid, Barca pressed? And I kind of sat back on Saturday evening having written this line in my match report. I thought, actually, they didn't, did they? That was sort of the thing that was disappointing about it. There wasn't much of a reaction. There wasn't much of a sign of character. We know we've seen it a lot this year that Barcelona can play 45 good minutes, maybe an hour, but they don't seem to be able to get to 90 minutes. I think their formation is still uncertain. I think it doesn't work in many ways. And It's too narrow. I think it exposes Busquets and De Jong, that which really isn't a good partnership or doesn't look like one. Whole load of people crowbarred into trying to be number 10s when obviously there's only one actual number 10 position. But as I say, the interesting thing for me, or one of the disappointing things from a Barcelona perspective, was that they didn't really react to having conceded that goal. At that point, Madrid played defensively, and Madrid are very good at holding on to a lead. And Barcelona, I think, just didn't find a way through. And then, of course, you get that Koeman change at the end, don't you? Where he makes three changes, which is brilliant because it creates three chances. It's just a pity they're all for Real Madrid.
Very quickly, give us the Messi happiness scale and the Gerard Piqué happiness scale as well, which we need to introduce.
Yeah, of course, Piqué had really weighed into them before the game. The Messi happiness scale, well, he didn't score. Six Clasicos in a row without a goal and without an assist. He hasn't scored a goal or provided an assist since Cristiano Ronaldo left. So maybe it's not about Messi. Maybe his unhappiness is actually the departure of Cristiano Ronaldo. And I now feel bad because I've introduced Ronaldo on a Messi discussion, which I always hate when people do because they're not actually mutually dependent, what would you call them, beings. But there you go. And also, you know, look, I personally think you take the first hour. Messi had one of those performances that if anyone else does it, we say, wow, he played well. Messi does it, we think, oh, he wasn't very up to much, was he? More touches than anyone else, more creativity than anyone else. I think possibly the best player on the pitch for an hour. But it is absolutely true that when Barcelona had to react, and at the point, in fact, curiously enough, and there's a contradiction inherent in this, the point at which everyone starts to look for Messi all the time, he then doesn't sort of lead them to victory. I'm not blaming him necessarily, but it is true that from the last half an hour, it doesn't happen when Madrid becomes super defensive. Well, not super defensive, but very tight, very well organised.
Sid, lovely to talk to you.
Pleasure. Cheerio.
I'll let you know when the next pod is.
Please do, yeah. Let the listeners know as well if you get the chance.
Yeah, I will do. Sid Lowe out in Spain. Cheers, Sid.
Cheerio.
Baz, can we have a tiny fit bar corner? Because Celtic didn't win. And we get to talk about Kemar Roofe's goal in the Europa League as well.
Yeah, Celtic failed to beat Aberdeen at Pittodrie. They went behind twice, pulled it back to 2-2, and then went 3-2 up and conceded a really daft penalty for a Shane Duffy foul on Conor McLennan. So Aberdeen equalised with that. Pressure on Neil Lennon, you'd have to say, because that comes on the back of defeat against AC Milan in the Europa League and the previous weekend's defeat at the hands of Rangers in the Old Firm Derby. So Rangers are now 6 points ahead of Celtic in the league, having played a game more. Celtic have to play Aberdeen in next weekend's Scottish Cup semi-final. This is from last season's Cup. And so Rangers will have a chance to go 9 points clear of them. Celtic have now conceded 8 in 3 games. Shane Duffy, one of their star signings, has not impressed at all. He's really having a hard time of it, a tough time of it, which kinds of, I don't know if he's missing Lewis Dunk or, but it's putting pay to the myth that, you know, playing for Celtic after playing for a Premier League side should be a breeze, because he's having a rough trot. And Neil Lennon is getting a lot of stick. He was getting stick for playing a back three. Now he's getting stick for playing a back four, but not leaving Scott Brown on the bench, so they had no shield in front of them. That caused, you know, a bit of panic. Olivier Nitchum gave away a silly penalty as well during the game. So Lennon can't do right for doing wrong at the moment, and there is pressure mounting on him. Rangers, on the other hand, are doing incredibly well under Steven Gerrard. They have a system that works. They're not as reliant on Celtic, on individual bits of genius to get them out of trouble. And they obviously won their Europa League tie. So you can tell us all about Kemar Roofe's wonder goal.
Well, I think Kemar Roofe's goal from the halfway line might be the best halfway line goal of all time. I mean, I certainly think it's better than, you know, Beckham, who had so much time, and, you know, better than a Naeem punt from the halfway line. I don't know what you think, John. I just thought it's one of the greatest goals I've ever seen. You have to have the caveat that you've got to have a bit of luck to score from the halfway line.
I still go with Beckham because of the sort of panache with which he did it. You know, the Roofe one was sort of instinctive, whereas the Beckham one was, it was planned. It had that bit of panache in the way he delivered it. Also, that one, I just love the way that Neil Sullivan just sort of jumps in the air and it sort of flops behind him. It adds that sort of comedy to it. Naeem from the halfway line, I'm not sure he was actually on the halfway line. So does that's discounted?
But it works in the song, doesn't it? Let us know. I'm sure there are plenty from around the world that, and you know, Xabi Alonso's done it about 100 times. So if you have any you prefer, do let us know. One story from the Football League, Jordan, that you pointed out, there's slightly disappointing phraseology, if that's a word, from the Bolton boss Ian Evatt, as he told his goalkeeper, Billy Crellin, to man up after conceding a goal.
It was disappointing when I saw that. It was sent to me by a couple of friends of mine. And I just think it's quite concerning, if I'm being honest, that it's 2020 and we're still using that sort of language. We've not long finished, I believe, Mental Health Awareness Week. And just, I think, publicly using that kind of language, I mean, even privately, it's disgusting. But publicly to kind of out someone with that sort of language, I just thought was unnecessary and says a lot about the manager himself. And I just thought, why are you doing that? Why are you saying that? At a time when we're seeing other players struggling with their form up and down the leagues, I just thought a bit more care with how we criticise individuals is definitely needed. And I just thought it was a bit crass, if I'm being honest.
This from Connor, which is quite the gear change. He just sent me a screenshot. Somebody saying, I've just turned on Chelmsford v Maidstone on YouTube. Lots of people obviously watching lower league games on iFollow and non-league games as well. And some of them are just done, you know, by whoever happens to be filming it. He says, I couldn't understand why they weren't filming the action, but kept panning to the away dugout when it transpired that they're filming with one of those VO cameras that tracks the ball. Very clever in principle, but the commentators have said it keeps picking up the bald linesman on the touchline and the bald assistant manager in the away dugout instead of the ball, which is tremendous news, isn't it? Now, England women's friendly with Germany on Tuesday has been cancelled after a member of the team's backroom staff tested positive for coronavirus. Phil Neville said, while we all wanted to play Tuesday's game, this was absolutely the right course of action. I thank Germany's staff for their understanding and our FA colleagues for their support. Some really sad news to finish the pod. Three pieces of sad news, in fact. Manchester City have paid tribute to former youth team player Jeremy Whiston after his tragic death at the age of 17. The defender was born in Malawi, moved to the UK with his family as a baby, joined City in 2016 and played for their elite development squads before leaving the club. The Man City family are saddened to learn of the passing of former academy player Jeremy Whiston, the club said in a statement on Twitter. We send our deepest condolences to his friends and family. Our thoughts are with you at this difficult time. We obviously echo that. You'll also remember me mentioning Daryl Grove, the host of the US podcast Total Soccer Show, being moved to a hospice. He sadly passed away since we did our last pods. Reading the tributes to him and listening to the pod that they just released saying goodbye to their friend, it just showed how much people loved him and how much they loved his work. And the same can be said for Kevin McCarra, the former football correspondent at The Guardian, one of the founder members of this podcast. He's died at the age of 62 after suffering from Alzheimer's. Jonathan Wilson wrote a really lovely tribute to him and joins us now. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey.
You wrote he was unashamedly erudite, also had great warmth, a pioneer who changed Scottish football journalism, but most fundamentally, he was a thoroughly nice man.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I think if you look at the tributes people paid to him over the last couple of days, and you know, I've had well over 200 replies on Twitter. Susan, his wife, yes, announced news of his death, and she's had far more replies than that. And you skim down them, and the same three words keep recurring, which are gentle, kind, nice. And yeah, he was one of the loveliest people you could ever wish to meet. And a lot of people who are at The Guardian now started in Kevin's time, and they all talk about how he'd make a point of introducing himself to them, of welcoming them. And he's had that great awareness of other people.
And Barry, like a key part of this, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure if he was on the first episode, but he was certainly a regular guest in what I call the wardrobe or cupboard years, when we were basically in an office in Farringdon, more or less recording in what was a cupboard with bits of foam stuck to the wall, sitting around a tape recorder shouting into it. I think a lot of people thought Football Weekly wouldn't grow legs, that we were all bonkers, but he was really enthusiastic about it, was always willing to come in and be an emergency guest when we were stuck. He was always welcome. Him and Amy Lawrence were huge supporters of the pod in the early years. I mean, I remember you'd be in the office with Kevin, he'd come over and start talking to you if he was bored or if he didn't have anything to do when he was in. And you might be up against a tight deadline, but because he was so nice, you wouldn't have the heart to tell him to just fuck off, you know? Even though you would want to. And he'd chat away about you or about Sunderland or about Celtic or about whatever the issue of the day was. And, you know, it was a pleasure to talk to him. And it's, you know, a regret that I'll never have one of those annoying conversations with him again.
Some of the tributes below the line of your piece, just read a few out. Jopster said, so sad to hear this. He was brilliant on Football Weekly, always generous and witty, much like his writing. Kurtz Caddy said he was so much a part of the Guardian Football podcast initially. One of the key reasons it succeeded. He was always worth reading and listening to. Joe says Football Weekly pioneered intelligent and witty sporting podcasts, and Kevin was a foundational part of that. And OCDC says many a Football Weekly was elevated with his insights and laid-back charm. He helped to educate me and many others in the era before everything went Twitter, an era I remember with great affection. Peak Football Weekly, says Ann Hager, a loss to the pod and a terrible loss now. And people mention his writing, Jonathan, like he was a brilliant writer.
Yeah, and his niceness is the most important thing about him. But there is a danger that in focusing on that, people, you know, sort of forget what an extraordinary talent he was. And what I hadn't realised... Yeah, I'd known the end was coming for a few weeks, and so I'd started doing research for this piece. And until I started doing that, I hadn't realised how revolutionary he'd been in Scotland. That he joined Scotland on Sunday when it launched in 1988, and he changed Scottish football journalism. That, you know, we think now of the early 90s being that sort of period of change in football media, so with, you know, with Fever Pitch and Italian football on Channel 4 and fanzines, and Kevin was sort of part of that in Scotland of changing what football journalism was. He made it much more literary. He took it away from the sort of, you know, from the cliches and the hackery it had been, and, you know, he sort of showed what it could be. So yeah, I hadn't realised quite how central he was to that movement. But he also, you know, he had an, you know, extraordinary life beyond football as well. You know, he ran a publishing house, co-ran a publishing house that published, you know, really serious poetry. I mean, Edward Morgan, you know, he published several of his works, including Sonnets from Scotland in 1984, and the cover of that was designed by Alistair Gray. So, I mean, these are huge names, which again I hadn't really, so I knew he had sort of the academic side, and I knew he'd sort of wandered away from his PhD, but I hadn't realized, and I knew he knew Edward Morgan, but I hadn't realized quite how influential he'd been in that world.
And Barry, for some reason, whenever he was on, you played Kevin Carter by the Manic Street Preachers.
Yeah, there was a stage, and I can't remember how it came about. I think listeners used to devise jingles for each of us. And Kevin's was a mashup of Kevin Carter by the Manic Street Preachers, which, you know, maybe we can dredge it up one more time for old time's sake.
Barry, what was your...
I can't remember. I honestly cannot remember something. I mean, they weren't tremendously witty or anything, but Kevin's was probably the best. And we have James Dean Bradfield and Nicky Wire to thank for that.
Finally, Jonathan, how should we remember Kevin?
Well, I mean, yeah, his niceness, his writing. I think Philippe actually came up with the perfect phrase, which was he was a gentle fanatic. So, yeah, he was a massive Celtic fan. And I imagine most of those conversations with Barry's talking about ended up talking about Celtic in 1967. Yeah, it was just sort of a natural gravity that you ended up with that. And he wrote a brilliant book, co-wrote it with, I think it's called Pat Woods, a guy he co-wrote it with, on the Lisbon Lions. And, you know, he knew all that side, and he interviewed them all. And, you know, I remember him sort of... And Kevin was a terrible footballer, apparently. Apparently, once at university, being asked to join in a side just to sort of make up the numbers. And after 10 minutes, they substituted him off because he was so bad, they thought we'd better playing with 10. But, I remember I was with Philippe at the time. I remember him starting to act out some particular move that Jimmy Johnson had showed him how he did, you know, in his living room. And even though he was a terrible footballer. Sort of his enthusiasm and the fact that, you know, Jimmy Johnson of all people had sort of shown him how to do this. He was utterly fanatic about Celtic, but he was never partisan with it. You know, he showed how you could support a club but still be very clear-sighted. And I don't think any Rangers fan would have any quibble with him over that. And, you know, there's a story as well that, with his niceness, he very rarely offended anybody. And then there was I guess, mid-90s, when Tommy Burns was Celtic manager. And Tommy Burns was famously one of the nicest people in Scottish football. And Kevin had written something about some signings or something that hadn't come off. And Tommy Burns was under a lot of pressure, this when Rangers were winning their 9 in a row. And just one morning at a press conference, he loses it. And he ends up with Kevin pinned against the wall. And so the way his team was described to me was, every standing going, the two nicest men in Scottish football are about to have a fight. What on earth do we do? And they end up kind of very quickly both just sort of laughing and realising how silly this was. And when Kevin got a Celtic shirt after he'd retired, and sort of he was thinking what number should he get on the back, and he got the number 10 because it was Tommy Burns' number. So they very quickly patched it up. So a lovely man, a great writer, and somebody who showed how you can support a team without being a twat about it.
Jonathan, look, it's a really lovely tribute, and I'd recommend everybody goes and reads it. Thanks for coming on, and thanks to John, Barry and Jordan for today's pod. It seems only right that we do play out with his jingle one final time. So, playing us out today on the pod is the Manic Street Preachers and Kevin Carter. Faye will be with you on Wednesday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.